Well, we're in the midst of who knows how long study. Say we're serious about the Bible, doing a series about the Bible. So I'm not misquoting here. It's just, we're serious about the Bible. And I'll remind you again that a contract secures the future and that the contract obligates the parties. And these are hard terms. These are like, you know, not soft. These are like statements made in a will, statements made in a contract. I will, you will. And usually, like when you buy a house, there is money put down, and it's called, what's it called? Earnest money. Earnest means you are earnest. Thank you. Sometimes the answers are really easy. In fact, if you're not earnest about it, you will give up your earnest money. So when somebody signs a contract, there is something behind it that makes it happen. And to some extent, the earnest money is that, because if you don't follow through on the contract, you give up the money. Now, you know, the earnest in a contract are sometimes, you know, depend on the value of the contract, maybe 10%, 1% housing. You know, it's really down pretty small. You know, so it more is sort of intention that you're going to do it. You know, if you put down half the value of the contract as earnest money, no one ever asks you to do that, but it would strengthen the contract, wouldn't it? Because the contract is only as good as the earnest money is good. So if the person is really willing to give up $1,000 on a $200,000 purchase, he found a better deal for $190,000, giving up the $1,000 is not a problem. So those contracts really are not very secure because earnest money isn't very much. Well, in God's contract with Abraham, what did God put down? How much was the down payment? His word. Nothing, zero, right? But his word. His word. Well, that's nothing. Well, wait a minute. But that is everything. So anyway, and we have the signing of the contract this week. Hope we get to it. And it shows that this contract is a serious issue. It's not just a flippant, yeah, we'll do it sometime. We'll get together sometime contract and never do. This is we're going to get together and it's going to happen contract. So anyway, I think we need to think about our Bible in those terms. I'm repeating myself, but we tend to think, world tends to think of the Bible as just a conglomeration or a collection of nice things to say, kind of a moral lessons to be learned. You know, it's nothing hard you run up against and bloody your nose. It's something that you could just manipulate, change it how you want. And it means different things to different people, different times. God's not really clearly defined, you know, who he is, what he is, you know, what he's up to. So all that's supposed to be done away with when you get serious about the Bible and find the Bible is a contract and it has solid intention. So in our series, The Bible as Contract, it has been my intention and trying real hard to do this to present the Bible as in hard terms rather than flexible ones. We don't need flexible words from God. We need to have concrete words from God that we can bank on because our life depends on it. Not this life only, but our life eternal. So we have a lot of beginnings in Genesis, a lot of starts in Genesis. So in the beginning of things, we learn how things are because it will carry through the rest of time. So we have the beginning of Genesis. There's no debate about how Abraham understood the language of God when he said, when God said to Abraham, go forth from your country, from your relatives, from your father's house, to a land I will show you. That was not misunderstood by Abraham. Because it says that Abraham went forth as the Lord had spoken to him. He departed from Haran. Now, I'm going to say this is the first time that God has spoken to man this way. He talked to Adam. And I can't remember if there's any other time that actually God comes down and interacts with humanity after Adam's fall and after the judgments have been given. It seems like God not goes away, but he cuts himself off from Adam because after all, that is what sin was. It cuts God off from his creation, or creation from their God. So this, in a sense, this discussion that God has with Abram is the first time since the fall that we have this kind of discussion between God and man. So this is 2,000 years. There's been a discussion with Noah, but it doesn't rise to this kind of discussion. Noah was instructed to build the ark and so forth. And By the way, do you ever think about the flood as an act of grace? How would it be an act of grace? He killed everybody, didn't he? How is that an act of grace? He saved eight. That's right. There's a grace. And say, well, that's an expensive compromise, you know, but he did save humanity. He did save humanity through one family. All right. So this is the first time, not exactly the first time because you got Noah in there too, but this is the first kind of a new kind. Never again has this happened. I believe that God gave Adam an account of instructions, going back to that. And we have that writing in Genesis 1 through 2, verses 3, which served as, I think, written revelation until Moses redacted, conglomerated the writings of that generation line from Adam. Now, this is my view of it, and I'm not the only one thinks this way, because if God would not have told, and I say when God gave Adam the record of the creation, I mean, he gave Adam the record of creation like God gave gave Moses the record of the law. Because how else would humanity know until Abraham or whoever? No, Moses actually. How would they ever know anything about their origins? So this is Genesis in, where did they get this from? Genesis in Genesis, there it is, biggest life. They break down the same idea that you have all these pieces, they're called toldoths, they're actually generations, records of generations are given in order that each would have kept their own, and they would have been compiled and assembled over time, and then Moses redacted them, put them together in one document. So I'm just showing you that. Answers in Genesis suggests a source material used by Moses in compiling the Pentateuch. All right, just that point. Now, a need for contact, which is our preamble in the contract. I've read this to you before. I'm going to do it again. Whereas a man has, this is how why the contract needs to be written. Whereas a man has exhausted the opportunities given by God to make reconciliation with his creator. Remember, the focus here is on man to do this. God now assumes his sovereign right to work a peace plan for man, on his own terms, and at his own expense. Man had his chance, now God is going to do it his way. And that's why we have the contract. Now we see all this is necessary because we know the bitter story. There is a necessity for God to break into the human family if the human race is going to survive. And that's what we talked about. Where is the grace of God in this? He could have just taken them all out. He kept eight back. So there's the grace. So what would happen? What do you suppose would happen to the families if they would have been taken out, families, the population of the earth? What would have happened if the flood would not have occurred? Let's just say God would have just let it go. What would happen if the flood would not have stopped the evil on earth? Would things ever get better? Anybody think that that would be possible because God just didn't wait long enough because eventually it would have got better? I don't even need to look up. Nobody's got his hands up, do you? No, things are not going to get better because after 1,600 years, it's not, you know, why would it? In fact, my question is, would mankind actually survive? And I've thought about this. If God would not intervene, mankind would start killing each other, and not that they weren't already. But that's where it would finally go. It would get worse and worse and worse. The human family would get smaller and smaller and smaller until the time you would have one person left, not two, one person left, and he'll die of old age. Yeah. You're talking about God interfering with this? Yes, you are. Let's say God doesn't interfere. Where's this going? If God does not interfere, humanity will die off. There's no reason why it would continue. Right. You're always putting God in everything. When you put God in everything, everything changes. And that's probably the thing that I want you to see here. You know, if God doesn't interfere with this, no one would be left on the face of the earth. I mean, they kill each other. Why wouldn't they? I mean, it's all one brute against the other. Now, it might take a few more thousand years, but eventually would fight each other to the point there'd be nobody left except two guys, and they duke it out, and one of those guys gets killed by the other, and the one that's left will obviously die because he's got no woman to have a child with, so the ends of the generation stops with him. So I just think the whole earth would have come to an end, screeching stop, and that's why we have the grace of God saving these eight people back and starting over again. Because as we have said in our premise, when God makes something, he keeps it, and it's his. And so he's not going to allow anybody, even his own curse, you might say, to destroy humanity. So they're going to come back with a vengeance, and this is with the story with Noah and all that kind of stuff. So we have a very, very, very dark picture of humanity up till Abraham. And when you get into Noah's time, after Noah's time, it doesn't get any better. It doesn't get better. So, well, they learned a lesson. Now they're going to, it doesn't get better. So we have God interfering with human on earth. And we have something that's very remarkable that God states up front through a contract, states issues about the future, obligates, in this case, he will obligate himself. Abraham is not obligated. So it's noteworthy that only a sovereign God can state up front a plan and have the power to carry it out. And we just said that what's the earnest here is his word. And he does it perfectly. So we have it, you know, another piling onto the amazing part of this is that humanity has been in existence for 2,000 years to Abraham. And so it's like, you know, shooting at the moon with a bow and arrow. How far is that going to get humanity doing this? You know, I'm going to do it my own strength. You can't even get out of gravity, the field of gravity. But here God says his plan that is going to go on for thousands of years, that everything just lines up exactly like he said it would. So Abraham shows up not a minute late, not a minute early, when all the things that the world needs to know or have tried or experimented with find they fail, finally, after 2,000 years, Abraham shows up in a certain family, a certain part of the world, and he's going to be blessed, and God is going to make that choice, and from that point, the world pivots. So I think the place of Abraham, 2,000 years into the human existence, and then another 2,000 years before his descendants, the Christ appears. I've often wondered about this. Why does Abraham appear halfway through this period? It's just about within years of exactly what it is, halfway. So, again, the idea that God can plan every detail for us, people who believe in the sovereignty of God in all things, is no big deal. But just think about the person who has not thought about that and think about the luck of it. And if you think of it from a man's point of view that he's in control of all these things, what's man trying to do here except to destroy what God has done? So the amazing aspect of all of God's sovereignty comes out through this whole account of Abraham, even the timing of it. Now think about, compare this in our world of arrogance about the ambitions of man to accomplish his things. And we just are in a terrible period of American politics these days, and these guys are all arrogant and ambitious for their power. And they're not getting anywhere, you know, and further they don't get that what they're, you know, the word that more... anxious or angry they get. So we just watch how man works at it, and he has no ability to predict tomorrow. He can't, you know, so we think that, look at God, what can he do? And he doesn't even lift a finger to do it. Well, there can be no question about the nature, timing, and extent of God's election when you look at Abraham. And so if God can do it with Abraham, he does it with people, places, and things. So when God does it, it's his ability, and it's flawless, and it will work his plan without exception. So is there anything in retrospect, whether in the Bible, history or prophecy, fulfilled or unfulfilled, that should not be concretely understood? And say, no, there's nothing. I hope that you say that. But, you know, we're in a minority here in terms of Bible believers. You know, a lot of these things that God has said, he's changed his mind about, but we're not of that group, I hope. So, does what it say need interpreting? That is to change it. You interpret things to change them, remember? And sometimes say, well, you interpret them to clarify them. Well, no. If you don't need to interpret, then you just read it, right? Then you just read it for what it says. So interpretation always is an opportunity to change it. What's how you interpret the Bible? I don't want to interpret the Bible. I just want to read the Bible. I want to believe what the Bible is. Say, well, we want to believe it for what it says. So they say, in this interpreting process, say, well, God's a mysterious person, and therefore his words cannot be literal. But I ask, is God really mysterious? Does God present himself as a mysterious person? Well, you can't know me to the extent that I am known, but you can know me. and we hang our whole life on that because it's his word that we're believing about him. So we have the law of call, the law of first occurrence that is used by Bible students to establish a meaning based on word usage. So the first time it occurs in the Bible, we sort of tend to say, well, now that's how it always is used, or the first use of it. How it is used the first time establishes a meaning. Well, we can apply the rule to God's conversation with Abraham, too. Is it not then a pattern for the future? There's no reason to believe that God is speaking in the figurative language to Abraham. So God's talk is expected to be literally understood. Certainly Abraham must have thought that. So Abraham was not tricked. He was not confused. He was not lied to. The land is not a spiritual land of heaven, a philosophical idea from the Greeks. God talked to Abraham about a real place, so real that Abraham got up with great effort and moved to it. I mean, Abraham was a wealthy person. And so it's not like you get in your car and you drive down the road to Denver, maybe the same distance. But those days, you had all the livestock, all the servants, whatever they were, slaves, what do you want to call them? You know, people that worked with them and all the army that he had with them. Now, these were small groups, but there was a lot of effort involved for Abraham to move. So he got up with great effort, moved to it, defending the five kings against it, dug wells as if he's planning to stay in it. Abraham said he is at home. So it is very disturbing as scholars who interpret the plan, insult the very character and glory of God. And said, well, that's what Abraham said, or say to Abraham, but that's not really what it meant. It meant at that time, but he changed what he really meant later on. When the church came on, now we got to change what he says. So, and to insist that the words of God are to be understood in a nuanced way, they say, is to depreciate, and they will, the seventh-day creation week, the actual person of Adam and Eve, and finally denial of the human condition, which leads you to the denial of even the redemption plan. I say, well, no, they won't go that far, but they do. They do. You see it again and again. If they live long enough and they keep writing what they believe, they slide off. And it's more than one person we can bring up on that. I just put this up. This wasn't in my lesson last week, but as a discussion of our lesson last week, I just put up the plan that Abraham understood, that I believe that Abraham, God was telling Abraham to expect. So we have, if I can do this, hey, that's not good. So we have the beginning, where we are in our lesson is right there where it's promised. Now, it's interesting that Abraham doesn't stay in the land very long. In fact, Jacob, his family, move out of the land. And they're in Egypt for, you know, centuries, waiting to be delivered. So all this time, I call this black. They're not really in the land. But it's a promise. It's a contract that it is their land. But they're not in the land. Moses comes to the land, occupies the land. They're in the land till 586 B.C., and then in the second captivity, the Babylonian captivity, they're out of the land for 70 years, and a remnant of them come back, maybe as few as 10,000. And so they're living in the land up till the time of Christ, but they're not in charge. They're not really a nation. They're under every other authority, Persian, Greece, and Roman, finally. And then we had the destruction of the temple and the city from 70 A.D. to 135 A.D. And the Jews are kicked out. No more temple worship, and there are no more people in the city in Jerusalem. So we have this church age, which is now nearly 2,000 years old. And Israel is not in the land. Although I could have put one in here somewhere about here. Let's say they're back in the land in 1948. Then they became a nation recognized internationally. And then we have the second coming. And at this point, the millennium starts, and the millennium, sometimes it gets its own name because it's 1,000 years, and sometimes we think the millennium is just, the kingdom is the millennium, and the extent of the kingdom is just the millennium. Remember, the Bible doesn't talk about it that way. The Bible talks about an eternal kingdom. So we have the eternal kingdom starts with 1,000 years in it, and then it just goes on into the earthly eternal kingdom. And then we have, at the same time, this new Jerusalem, the abode of the saints. Now, this is those that have died from the time of Adam down to the second advent. Those that have died have got spiritual bodies, are inhabitants of the new Jerusalem. Okay, and the ones on earth continue to have children. You know how that works. All right. So that's how we think of it. A lot of times, this is how it's usually a lot of times taught about, is that this new Jerusalem, somewhere off in another space, there's a burning up of the atmosphere of the earth, the stellar heavens, whatever. And as some have said, to the atomic level. And then there's this break into the non-physical realm. And I'm arguing more and more strongly that this is just simply a Greek idea. The more I read, the more I'm convinced that that is true. Now, let's go back to Abraham. Whoops, get rid of that. Put on the right buttons here. Now, what did Abraham understand? It says in Hebrews that by faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed, went out to a place which was to he was to receive for an inheritance. Remember, with a lot of effort, he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land. Remember, bought a burial plot for his wife, dwelt in tents, which meant nothing permanent, with his son Isaac and his grandson Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. I'm still reading Hebrews here. Now, the next phrase is very interesting. For he was looking for a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Now, it's real easy to go Greek here and say, well, see, that is that other dimension, New Jerusalem off in the heavenlies. Not necessarily, because we have the New Jerusalem that comes down from heaven, and I think that's, and it becomes part of the earth, part of the kingdom. And that's where Abraham is seeing. So now I'm saying to myself, what did Abraham know about this eternal city? Was he just sort of using a phrase here that didn't really mean what it said? In other words, the city, well, the land isn't really a city, is it? So how is Abraham looking for a city whose foundation, architect, and builder is God? That's not the kingdom, is it? We say, well, Abraham's looking for a kingdom. So what I'm saying here is I think Abraham knew something here that he didn't elaborate on. Because he is going to die before he realizes the promises. So what's he looking forward to? He's going to realize he dies, so he knows he's going to be into this other city is where he's going to end up as in resurrected bodies. Now, what God told Abraham, we don't know. I mean, besides what's written. So I don't want to read into this. Now, this builder of the city, the city whose foundation, whose architect and builder is God, that is some other dimension place. It's no different than what Jesus went away to prepare for us in John chapter 14. So I'm just saying, I don't know that Abraham tells us what he meant here. I don't know. I think Abraham understood because he knew he was going to die, or he did die, and without it being fulfilled, but yet his faith was still secure because he understood that this was his place where he was actually heading. Okay, just that point, that Abraham's looking for a city, and don't mean to figuratize the city. It is actually a city. It's called the New Jerusalem. That doesn't get elaborated on in Hebrews. Well, it's always the wise who come up with this, and I thought about this verse in Job. It says, he does not regard any who are wise in heart, the wise, the wisdom, the sophomoric, I call them. And so when irrelevance matters, these guys become irrelevant, and that matters. I mean, we think that we look to them as, you know, people that have wisdom and the word, and they can explain things we can't see. And yeah, I know it says this, but it really means this. That wisdom, that kind of doesn't matter. So we've got to be careful of that we don't succumb to the wisdom of the world. So back to our plan. So if God is going to break into human family, we can readily see the necessity to choose one man, and God chose Abraham. Now, I thought about this, you know, God tells us what he's going to do, but I'd say if we didn't know what God is going to do, if that's impossible, it came from Mars, what would we explain that God would have to do in order to make it work? I don't know that we'd ever come up with a plan. We just somehow have some kind of moral reinforcement to make man do better or whatever, but never come up with this plan. Note, if we observe God's work, it would be impossible to anticipate what God needed to do to restore his creation. I don't think we could ever would have come up in 100 years, 100 million years, this plan that God came up with. So God chose Abraham. That is a plan. If God chose Abraham, it is uniquely, equally true that he did not pick any of us. You know, some of us, you know, maybe have had struggled with Arminianism. So remember, this is true. If God didn't pick Abraham, why didn't he pick you? If you want to be mad at God, he should have picked you, right? I mean, after all, you're a person. Why not you? Well, if you're a little smart, you say, I don't want to be Abraham. I don't want to be Abraham. This is too much trouble. But the fact of the matter is, why did he pick Abraham and not anybody else, not any of us? All right. So no one else has ever been picked. No one else was ever picked except Abraham. So this elevates the uniqueness of the choice, the time and the place, the person, all have to do with the exact time for God's plan to take root. Remember, 2,000 years, you know, down to the day. It's like shooting at the moon and being able to pull it off with an arrow, bow and arrow. Well, what about all those poor people who did not get chosen? That's all the rest of us, really. What kind of complaint can they register? What kind of disagreement can they raise? I raise all this up here because we have this argument with Arminianism and Calvinism, that the Calvinists, Arminians always want to say that God's not fair to do these things unilaterally without consulting us. We certainly had a part in it, and therefore God participates with us in order to have the favorable outcome. Well, that doesn't work that way, and Abraham is an example of why it does not work that way. So we come to Abraham. Who is Abraham, we asked. Is a man or a woman selected out of the post? He is a man selected out of, and a woman with Sarah, I've got to include her. A man selected out of the post-flood population, a man of no faith in the Creator God, who was chosen for his own purpose. We have no other reason given. It was a choice with the greatest gravity imaginable. It was a choice of privilege, duty, and obligation. It is an election that cannot be shaken or abandoned, no matter how grievous the failures or how earnest is the diselection. I don't know how well I could go on for pages, I guess, to secure this election. So, an election of Abraham, while a contract is an unbreakable promise, it is clearly the intention of God. It is equally acknowledged that what God did is odious to the sinful heart. That's why he cannot get over this issue that God actually is in charge, because I want to be. So how many discussions have we all had with people who think God cannot act in this manner? And usually preface it with, I don't think that God would, and they go on. So why all this distemper raised against God for doing what must be done? It is the very thing needed. Again, I come with a, you come with a better, you can, your friends, whoever, come up with a better plan. If this wouldn't work, what would work? If this isn't just, if this isn't fair, come up with a plan. They can't. I know they can't, but they don't want to think about that. They just want to reject the plan that is there. So a reading of the text shows that in time, everyone's mouth will be closed at this point. No one's going to argue with this when it's all said and done. In fact, God asked Job, who are you? And that's a good place to start with anybody. Who are you to talk back to God? Who are you to come up with a better plan, even if you would try? And Paul says that when it's all said and done, every mouth will be shut that ever lived that would raise a question against God. So, you know, it's time to get, you know, to be an early adopter and quit criticizing God for what he's done and appreciate it. So when God called Abraham, he did not call me. He didn't call billions of others. He didn't call the Donalic. Covenant was never to be. It's Abrahamic, nobody else. And I should appreciate it. So I asked a rhetorical question. Why is it so hard to ascribe full sovereignty to God? Why is it so hard? Why is it so hard? It just seems so unfair. Well, what God does is fair. So there you have a definition of fair. Okay. So to work the plan of God, God must choose a man to make connection with his creation. I talked to you about the other day about what is the link between God and humanity. Well, really, it's Abraham. Because without Abraham, there wouldn't be no Jesus. So I know Jesus is that place where he, you know, in the end we see that. But without Abraham, that is actually where the link starts. You know, God's going to decide, I'm going to be part of the human race. And I got to do that through a human being. And that's Abraham and Sarah. So that's the link. And that link continues clear down to Jesus. That's why the genealogies are kept. So to work the plan of God, God must choose a man to make the connection with his creation. So he chose Abraham and not another soul. Thus, Abraham is used throughout Scripture as a positive example. Romans 4, the whole book is, the whole chapter is dedicated to his faith. The Jewish understanding is that Abraham and Moses, who ought to occupy these great honors. And I just went through the Bible and was a little surprised that the occurrences, just as, this is not scientific in terms of what it means, but how many times do these names come up in the Bible? Now, I know it depends. If you're in a narrative, like telling a story, the name's going to come up a lot oftener than you're going to talk, than it would come up in the theological section. But just as a comparison, we have Abraham 283 times, Moses more times, 872, David the most, 1,080, that gives to about the time when he was in office, not quite. And with Jesus, a little bit less, and Jacob 361 times. So these are personalities in the Bible whose just names are mentioned for no reason, for whatever reason. So Abraham is not the top, but he's certainly significantly mentioned. However, Abraham, being human, becomes overwhelmed with his old age that his family has been denied him, even with the promise. It seems like this is no longer possible for him, he says. Remember, Abraham is 75 years old when he entered the land. He lives 10 years before Ishmael is born, another 14 before Isaac is born. So we have around 25 years. But for all this, there is a serious discussion between Abraham Abraham and God over this issue. Abraham and Sarah have no children. Then later, through the scheming of Sarah, Ishmael is born, but God is clear he is not the son of promise. The son must be born of Sarah. God did not abandon Abraham at this point. See, Abraham said, oh, I wish my Ishmael would be accepted before you. And God says, no. And God could have said, well, Abraham, with that attitude, I'm going to get somebody else. He doesn't. Again, the grace of God is evident. God did not abandon Abraham reluctantly. Abraham submits to God's choice of Isaac as the promised son. Now back to Abraham's discussion. Now, Abraham is noticeably worried as he misunderstood. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision saying, do not fear. Again, the no children issue here. I am a shield to you, and your reward, which will be your offspring, shall be very great. And Abraham said, oh, Lord God, what will you give me, since I am childless and the heir of my house, Eliezer of Damascus, not a blood brother or blood son? Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him saying, the man will not be your heir, but the one who comes forth from your own body shall be your heir. And he took him outside and said, look at the star heavens, count the stars, you'll be able to count them. Then he said, so shall your descendants be. Object lesson, literally understood. And then the next verse is the salvation verse of the whole Bible. And he believed the Lord, and he counted him, reckoned to him as righteousness. And that whole idea is not strange, because Revelation, the eternal gospel, is called fear God and give him glory. That's the whole gospel. So anyway, this is the pattern of faith that we now is established 2,000 years into the human existence, and that we have with Abraham. And God goes on to say, I am the Lord who brought you out of the Ur of the Chaldeans, give you this land to possess. And then Abraham says, oh, Lord God, how may I know that I will possess it? Now, is there doubt here? I don't know. We're not going to say that there is or there isn't. I guess it'd be common, typical human reaction. I'm, 99 years old and no children. You promised me my child. What am I going to do? And God is very gracious to him. He said to him, bring me a three-year effort, a three-year-old female goat and a three-year-old ram and turtle dove and a young pigeon. He brings them to him. And he brought them together and cut them in half and laid each half on the other. But he did not cut the birds. The birds of prey came down on the carcasses, and Abraham drove them away. Now the sun was going down deep. Sleep fell upon Abraham, and behold, a terror and great darkness fell upon him. So we have Abraham bringing these carcasses. Now we many times taught about cutting the covenant, and that's where we get this from. There are also other ways of making covenants. Remember, when you make a covenant, you have to pledge certain assets, that you'll give these assets up if you don't perform. In this case, what you give up, the asset you give up here, is your own life. Now, these animals are killed at great expense. We have, these are large animals here, some of them. Those large animals would have cost a lot of money. I mean, no one ever asks you to do that when you buy a house. Not that kind of earnest money. But this is a pledge which says that the parties that involve themselves in this contract are subject to the same treatment if they don't perform. Now, we know we're ahead of this already. You know Abraham is standing over here on the side. He's not part of this. We find that God will go through it. But that's what we have here. There are other things. You've heard this too. Sometimes you have a contract. Remember, contracts are meetings of the mind. This is still true today, law. You have a meeting of the line. If you can prove that you have a meeting of the line, whether it's in writing or not, that contract is enforceable. Maybe more difficult, but the actual fact is that there was a meeting of the mind, and it was observed and defended in a court of law. It's a firm contract. So what you did those days, you'd either exchange a shoe or you throw salt over, and what that did was that somebody observed you doing that. You saw two people made this contract that you'd do this at the city gate probably, and where others were observing, and these guys say publicly what they're doing, and one guy gives a shoe to the other, and they exchange shoes. You know, that wasn't something that happened, you know, by an earthquake. It was actually a voluntary act, and assault, the same thing, a voluntary act. Well, if there's a voluntary act to agree with the conditions of the contract, you're bound by it. Well, on a heavier contract like this one apparently is, the salt and the shoe exchange wouldn't work. For one thing, you don't exchange shoes with God because Abraham's not going to give his to God. This is a unilateral contract, so it doesn't work either. But this is a gravity, and I like this way this is drawn. It has these animals cut, and the blood, I don't know if this is how it would have actually been, but he has it shown that they pull the blood and it runs down together. So this is a bloody contract. This is a contract of great importance and great weight. So now we have something that's kind of unusual right here. Before the contract is signed by God, God said to Abraham, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in this land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed in the land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. But I will also judge that nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions." The Egyptian, called the Exodus. "As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you will be buried in the good old age." See, that's where Abraham has to resort to the New Jerusalem in his mind. He's got his heavenly city where he's going. He's dying. He knows that way up front. "Then in the fourth generation, they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." All I'm saying here is that the idea that they have to be in the land to own it is already told up front. You're not always going to be in the land, but it's always going to be your land. So out of the land does not mean abandonment now or ever. This heads off any idea that occupation is ownership. You know, occupation is not 9/10 of the law. You know, it's a contract filed at the city county building determines ownership. So if ownership is occupation. So if you own it, you got to live in it. If you live in it, you own it. Both don't work. Ownership is by title deed, which God holds on behalf of Abraham. That's how it's held. Don't forget that, because we want to make ownership based on occupation. The Palestinians today want to make ownership based on occupation. And the Jews have not been in the land, sometime we might say, for 1,500 years or more, almost 2,000 years. But they're still owners of it, because just because you don't occupy it doesn't mean you don't own it. Some of you have rental property. You don't own it. You don't live in it, but you let somebody else live in it, but it's still yours, right? Same principle. So God lets somebody else rent the space that's Jewish, but when God says, "I want my family to live in it, I'm going to have to evict these upstarts and put in my family." Okay, so occupation comes, and it does, and goes as it did. Comes and goes as it did for Jacob, Abraham almost right away, the captivities, the diaspora, all beginning nearly immediately. So I think that's why God puts it up front, says, "I'm going to give it to you, but you're going to be out of the land a lot." In fact, if you look at the years that they're out of the land, they're out of the land much more years than they're in the land, as it has worked out. So we have the signing of the contract. This is back to the Bible, Genesis 15:17. "It came about when the sun set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch, which passed between these two pieces." Now, this has always puzzled me exactly what these pieces are, and I read somebody, and I think that's probably the best I've ever read. The smoke in the oven, smoking oven, the darkness of judgment, the torch is the light of righteousness. So you have extreme characteristics of God, in terms of righteousness and judgment, exhibited here in these two symbols. And they sail through these two pieces. These both represent God's essential character, his judgment and his righteousness. All right, so I think that I like that the best. If you come with a better one, that's fine. I mentioned this last couple of weeks ago. Eliot mentions that Abraham probably passed between these immediately, and after arranging these particles, so therefore, then Jehovah does the same thing. So we have a bilateral covenant. I say that's what everybody wants to make it. There's no indication that Abraham did this. It's just all it says is what God did. All right, so that's what you get in the commentaries. Kyle and Dalitz, I think, did a nice job here. Abraham. Birds of prey are represented by the foes of Israel. These are the anti-Semites over the years. He's got to keep, you know, pushing them away as best he could. They would seek to eat up and exterminate the contract. They're, you know, the Palestinians, the Arab nations these days in our time are trying to nullify what Abram had said. So in a sense, Abram has got to keep chasing off these flies that attack the carcasses. And so we have Abraham and the Jews of Israel today. Just take that as an example today. They're continually fighting the people that come to take away the promises that God gave them for the land. So we have Jameson Fawson Brown, the dispensational guys. I like them. They say that take them in effort and occasion of great importance. With two or more parties join in a contract, they either observe precisely the same rights as Abraham did, or they do not. They invoke the lamp as a witness. So in some sense, this lamp with the light witnesses to this contract. According to these ideas, which have been from time immemorial engraven in the minds of Eastern people, the Lord himself condescends to enter into contract with Abraham. The patriarch did not pass between the sacrifices, and the reason was that in this transaction, he was bound to nothing except God's word, his character. He asked a sign, and God pleased to give him a sign by which, according to Eastern ideas, he bound himself. There we have this unilateral contract. So in Genesis 15:18, on that day the Lord made, first time, said, a contract with Abraham. It would seem like the contract with Abraham is understood as inviolable. It cannot be changed, not enforced, or spent in wanton disobedience. So why is this such an issue? Why cannot God make his own choice, his own plan, without meddling of the stepchildren? The Gentiles are the stepchildren here. And they're always meddling with this promise. And they're the grafted in people. With the elaborate signing ceremony, it should settle the idea that Abraham is a recipient of God's gracious promises. It's irrevocable. Now, Abraham's contribution is one son. I got thinking about that. Is exactly how is it his contribution? Who made Abraham's body? Did not God? So one sperm cell is all he contributed, and he didn't even make that to make the son. Abraham understood this. Abraham understood it this way. He was there, after all. How is it that scholars have been able to deconstruct the event, strike out the name of Abraham, and write in their own names? In any other place, this would be the high crime of identity theft, which is exactly what's happened here. So on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants, I have given this land, and from the river of Egypt to the great river Euphrates, Kenites, Kenizzites, and Kadmonites. And this contract is unconditional, unilateral, literal, and eternal, signed by one who can enforce and deliver the terms. And what I show you here has, after the Christian church came on the scene, after the second century, we saw these Jewish promises get darker and darker and darker and darker until they're gone away. By the time you get to Augustine, they're actually gone before that. But Augustine makes it official because the Jews have been Christ killers. Now, all along, everybody else been getting grace, but Abraham and his descendants get no grace. And I think that's why the stepchildren should be quiet and let the children have the promise.